So we finished a series in Matthew last week and have 1 week to transition from the sheer brilliance of the resurrection to the utter impossibility of the incarnation. And I find myself absolutely inadequate to do that on any level at all. The nature of language, especially my language, leaves it wanting to try to communicate the grandeur and the essence and the glory and the beauty of Jesus. To try to use language to define and to describe God is like lighting a match in the noonday sun and holding that match up to the sun and saying, "Do you see the match?" when all you can see is the sun. And so our only hope together today is that the sun would join us here and that we would see the sun and the sun would change us. And so by nature of the very restrictions of limited humanity, this is an impossible conversation, but it's even more complex than that, right? We're so programmed about Christmas. The moment we try to think about it on a profound level, our OCD kicks in almost immediately. And we start thinking about 8 pounds, 6 ounce baby Jesus, who was born in a Thomas Kincaid barn in the hillside of France with light snow falling in the background. And the problem is, Jesus wasn't French or English or Caucasian, and it probably did not snow in a Mediterranean climate in the middle of the desert, and this wasn't a peaceful event. This was birth in the first century. This was blood and agony and sweat and exhaustion and then euphoria. That's birth, and that's how the story plays down. And yet the scriptures say this: there's something definitively different about this birth. And so let's look at it together. If you have a Bible, turn to Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. We'll start just with the first few words. And it says, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given." Now, that's enough content for 10,000 sermons. Just those few words could last us a lifetime. And so let's start with this angle, because we could choose a multitude of angles. Without the particularities of Christianity, just discussing the existence of God, by nature, deity means enormity. It means no restrictions. It means all power, it means all presence, it means all knowledge. And so how could we possibly say that the infinite deity could constrict itself to the fragility of infancy? How could we say that, right? It's impossible to compact the might of God. It's impossible to constrict the presence of God. You cannot confound the knowledge of God into an infant. And so conceptually, we would have to say, this can't be. And yet, if deity does mean enormity, then maybe it provides for us an impossible possibility, right? If he is deity with all power and all knowledge, then can he not figure out a way to put the full essence of God compacted and squished and scrunched down into a little child just by the sheer power of who he is, right? Like, we'd have to ask, why would he do that? And we will ask that question in a minute, but at least it's plausible as an impossible possibility that because of power, God can do this thing. Now, these are just thoughts without the particularities of Christianity. Let's add now the specific things of Christianity. Are we really saying that the God of the Bible can be born as a human being, right? Because in Samuel, it says this: God cast down giants just at his presence. Are we really suggesting that God in infant form can still cast down giants? Or it says in the scriptures this: it's better to be in the presence of God for a day than anywhere else for 1,000 years, right? Pick a place. Pick a place of pleasure, pick a place of peace, pick a place that's euphoric, and you could stay there forever, or it would be better for you just for a minute to be in the presence of God. That's his goodness. And so we're suggesting that in this infant, all of the goodness of God is there, and better to be with this infant for an instance than just to be anywhere else forever. Or the scriptures say this in Psalms, that the mountains melt like wax in the presence of God. It says in Joshua that God speaks and the sun stands still. It says in Exodus that God, through an old man with a stick, brought down the only world power because of his presence and his power. And then it says in Genesis that the words of God are so powerful and so effective that when he says hydrogen, hydrogen formed. And when he said matter, matter took its place. And when he said exist, bang, everything came into existence. existence, that God is now born as a child on this planet, that definitely is the impossible possibility, but in his power, it's at least plausible. But he goes on, it's not just that a child is born, but a son is given. Right? A child being born is a non-specific event. 350,000 children are born in the United States every day. 3.5 million children are born worldwide every day. So that's not a big deal. But a son given is part of a specific family. And this son is born of a particular family, the family of God. This is literally the Son of God. Now, as a thinking person, you have to at least consider that. How did Isaiah, 750 years before the birth of Jesus, write down with amazing precision his birth, his life, and his death? Some want to say that people came back and redacted the passages later to make it fit, but we have passages from Isaiah, manuscripts that are right around the time of 750 years before Jesus, right? If you're a thinking person, that's a little bit disturbing if you don't believe, is it not? And you owe it to yourself over the next 6 weeks to have some intellectual integrity and actually study this thing, read books by people that are brilliant, that wrote about this topic, and to sit down with followers of Christ and discuss this and play it out. Because in this church, city leaders believe, and surgeons believe, and men and women at the top of their profession believe, and brilliant stay-at-home moms and dads, they believe too. And it's not blind faith, it's enlightened faith. And so you owe it to yourself to be a thinking person and apply your intellect to this. But look, you're not just a thinking person. Right? You're artists and you're comedians and you're designers and you're risk takers and you're adventurers and you're entrepreneurs and you have passion and heart and gut and will, and you should apply every aspect of who you are to see if this thing has any weight to it, right? With all that you are, you should ask, why would God allow himself to become powerless as an infant? Why would God lower himself to the point where the ones he created mock him and accuse him of things that aren't true? Why would this God hang on a cross when he could call every power in the universe to come down and eradicate his enemies and make him safe? Why would he do this, right? That becomes the most important question ever poised on the lips of a man or a woman. It becomes the question that overshadows all the rest of history. Why? Why? Because my son can't do this. And no matter how great your son is, and parents always think their children are amazing, your son can't do this. Only his son can do this. And so his son became one of us. So what allowed his son to accomplish these things? That's a really key question. And Isaiah 9:6 goes on to play that out. Look back at the passage, if you will, with me. It says this: his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor. Now, sometimes the most simplistic words are the words that we skip over. And in skipping over the simplistic words, we miss the deeper meaning. Like adjectives, lots of times are just full of fluff and we think they're extra words. We kick that out. And so we look at this word wonderful and that doesn't really mean anything. But this word wonderful is critical here, right? Wonderful is not a word on the spectrum of bad to good. It has nothing to do with that. Sometimes we think it's this way. It's really bad, and then bad, neutral, good, and then wonderful. And you should just erase that thinking entirely. Wonderful broken down means full of wonder. And wonder means to provoke awe. It means astonishment. It means phenomenon. That's different than good. Phenomenon, right? You've been in some places where you've been astonished. I sat on the beach in Hawaii at Waimea Bay one time and watched 60-foot waves crash down in front of me and was astonished with 400 other people that looked on at this event. I've seen a tornado rip through my neighborhood, destroying houses, twisting trees in an instant, picking up decks and turning them perpendicular, taking grills to a distant place never to be found again. And to think that that phenomenon was a second or two in length and then just gone. I've held a child that fortunately looked more like Kimberly than me, but was my child, and I held that child and in silent astonishment wept at the goodness of God, right? These things are phenomenons and they are astonishing, but they're limited, right? They come, and then in a second later, they're absolutely gone. They have no more existence to them at all. And that's the really shocking part of Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. This phenomenon is in a second or an hour or a day. It's not a 60-foot wave that crashes down and then it's gone. It's everlasting. The sun will astonish for the rest of time. That's what the word wonderful means. And then the odd part is it's connected with counselor. Right? Now, I'm a big fan of going to see somebody wiser than you and letting that person apply the gospel to your life. That's called wisdom in the Old Testament. The fool stays alone. And so I have a counselor that I go to see, but I've never once walked into his office and said, "Hey, what's up, phenom?" That would be weird. I've never been astonished by him, right? I walk in and I say, "I know you're going to mess with my brain a little bit today. You better fix it before I leave." Those are the starting words every time, right? And so it's good to sit with a counselor, but this is not an invitation for you to find a counselor to sit on a leather couch to get comfortable and have that person stir some emotions up. That's not what's being requested of you here. Counselor, biblically, is a person who is a veteran in combat and had lived through multiple battles, and he knew the oncoming onslaught, and he knew how to survive. And so when battle was about to take place and the two armies had lined up and they were going to crush each other, the counselor would walk out, turn his back to the enemy and say, "Don't look at the enemy. Focus here on me. Look only at me in this moment. Don't worry about anything else. I know, but look at me. I've been here before. I know exactly what's about to happen. I'm going to live through this day. And if you stay with me and if you do what I say for you to do, you'll make it through today." This is an invitation to come and sit with the counselor, Jesus. He's full of astonishment. And if you listen to him, he'll take you to life, right? If you're tired of walking around in the darkness, he knows the way out. That's wonderful. And if you're tired of heading towards death and finding death in your life, he knows the way out of death. He's been there before. He knows that onslaught. And follow him. It's wonderful, right? And if you want life, he doesn't know the way to life. He is life. And he gives it to you, and that's wonderful. And so he invites you to this eternal astonishment at the goodness of God for you and for me. And Isaiah says this, his name is not only Wonderful Counselor, but it will also be Mighty God. Now, my family has been listening to Christmas music since July the 5th. And that's insane. And it's wrong. It's breaking the rule. The rule in the rule book clearly says it has to start the day after Thanksgiving. That's the rule, right? And so they're breaking rules, and I feel like I'm entitled to break a rule as well. And the main rule that they place on me is no potty talk, right? When daddy does potty talk, everybody else does. And potty talk in our family is any bodily function, any talk that belongs just in the bathroom, any picking and putting in your mouth, any of that, right, is potty talk. And I found a brilliant solution to Christmas music before Thanksgiving. I'm inserting potty talk into the lyrics of Christmas songs, right? That ruins the mood immediately. You sing Jingle Potty a few times, bam, everything's different, right? Now, here's what's happening in this room right now. Any person who ever wants to be a mom or is a mom hates me at this moment. And every dad here is already thinking of songs that they can do the same thing to. That's the brilliance of the communication here, right? Have you ever really listened to the lyrics of Christmas songs? They're kind of disturbing, right? This one, Santa Claus is coming to town. You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. Why? He's going to find out. That's really creepy. Does he have like microphones in our house? Is he spying on us? Santa Claus is doing these things. And then it goes on and it says, he knows when you've been bad or good. He knows when you're awake and he knows when you're sleeping. What? Right? You've had those nightmares that some creepy man is standing over you while you sleep. And tonight you find out that it's actually Santa Claus. That's what it says in this passage, right? And so what we've done is we've made Santa Claus sovereign. He can know everybody at one time. And we've made Santa Claus creepy. He sneaks into your room at night. And we've made Santa Claus full of religion. If you don't act really good, he's going to punish you. That's some messed up parenting, but it's the songs that we sing to our kids. Night, night, sweetheart. Go to sleep now. Jesus is mighty, but he's not creepy. And he's not religious at all. Listen to what it says in Psalm 103, verses 15 through 17. As for man, His days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field. For the wind passes over it, and it is gone, and its place knows it no more. But the steadfast love of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting on those who fear him, and his righteousness to his children's children. Do you see what he just said? That God can pick up your life like a man picks up a book, and he can see the entirety of your life in a single moment. He can open your life and he can see the table of contents and he can see each chapter and he can say, I know that chapter. I was there with you. It's not that I read it. It's that I was there. I experienced it with you. And then he can turn to the back and he can say, look, you haven't been here yet. You haven't been to the conclusion, but I have. I know the conclusion already and it ends better than you can imagine. And he can turn to page 1002 and he can say, this moment was sweet in your life. You rejoiced and I was there with you and I laughed and I was glad that you experienced these things. And I helped foster this for you because I adore you and you're my child. And he can turn to page 722 and he can say, this was the darkest moment of your life. You were crushed by somebody else. You did a horrific thing and I was there. I didn't do that to you, but I was there in that moment. I was with you. I didn't forsake you, right? He can focus in on every single moment and he can deal with those moments, whether they have gone past already or they're still in front of you. He sees all of your life and he's dealing with it and moving with it. Now, when we first hear this concept that God can hold our whole life like a book, it's a little bit terrifying. When men and women in our lives have specific information about us, especially broken things, human nature is to put that in their back pocket and to use it against you when the time's right. Right? I'm pretty amazed often that you can do 90 good things. You can labor to love somebody. And if you fail once or if you do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing just one time, they attach to that thing and they just use it against you. Your enemies use it for your downfall. Your friends use it to make themselves feel better. Your loved ones use it to get an upper perspective at times. And when people do that to you, you feel betrayed, and you don't want anything to do with them at all, right? People use bad things to ruin you, and so Jesus having insight and knowledge about you seems dangerous at first, but Jesus takes the most mighty force, and he applies it to these moments. And according to Psalm chapter 103, the most mighty force is steadfast love. Why would the Son be born? So that he can seal his steadfast love over and in your life. See, the most mighty thing that God could do is join us. He joined us, right? Not like other gods, not like other religions, that God showed up for a little bit, said some stuff, and then poof, was gone. He didn't really become, he didn't really experience, it wasn't really vicarious. No, this God joined us. He became human and he lived an entire lifetime. And he bled and he sweat and he laughed and he ate and he rejoiced and he danced and he knew people and he was known by people. He joined us. That's the most mighty force. And then he replaced us, right? I'm the most sinful person here. I can guarantee you that. And at the end of his life, he looked at me and he said, I'm going to replace you with me. I'm going to take what's yours and you're going to take what's mine and we'll trade. And this trade is going to be the best thing that's ever happened to you and the worst thing that could ever happen to anyone, me especially. He replaced me with himself as he hung on a cross. And he did this because he joined us and he replaced us so he could rescue us, right? His birth allowed for his life and his life allowed for his death and his death allowed for his resurrection and his resurrection allowed for steadfast love. He rescued you. And he rescued me. Because of steadfast love, the bright morning star faded. Life itself was extinguished. God did die. And in that moment, the Pharisees rejoiced and the disciples watched in with horror. The angels couldn't believe what was transpiring and that God wouldn't let them save Jesus. And Satan in that moment declared that he was the only power left in all of the universe, that he alone was supreme. But what Satan forgot and hell forgot and the Pharisees forgot is that Jesus is mighty God. And you cannot put mighty God in the grave. And you cannot kill mighty God. That this mighty God will outlive death and obliterate the grave. And he came back to life. And on the third day, all who believes can be joined and replaced and rescued by this God. And so my question for you is this. Have you forgotten that Jesus is mighty God? Do you really buy into death still? Do you really think that the grave is your end? Because the promise of steadfast love is this. If you come to the Son will give you the opposite of your sin. The opposite of your sin. Is your sin adultery? If it is, with Jesus, you get marriage to him. Do you know how sweet that is? Is your sin hatred? Because when you hate somebody, it rots your heart. And if your sin is hatred, you get peace of God as the response of Jesus. Have you oppressed others? Or are you oppressing yourself with addiction? Is that the thing that you're enslaved to those things? With Jesus, you get liberty. With gossip, you've crushed other children of God, and yet you get the very sweet words of Jesus in response. And so come to this one who is mighty God and let him change you. He's mighty God. Then Isaiah goes on, there's more. It's richer than this even. He says, his name shall be called Everlasting Father. Now, many of our fathers are good men, but sinful and blew it. And then some of our fathers are just train wrecks. And what we usually do is we take what our fathers did in our young life, and we apply it to God, and it makes our relationship with God the Father very difficult, right? Some of your fathers were absentee. They were in the home, but they weren't present. You don't have memories with them. They were in fantasy worlds. They were in fantasy sports. They were all in their careers. They were too tired to be engaged. And so you needed discipline, but you never got it. And you needed mercy, but you never got it. And you needed your daddy to say you're forgiven, but you never heard those words. And so what happens is you don't trust your earthly father. How could you? When you don't trust your earthly father, you don't trust God the Father. How could you trust him? But some of you, you didn't have absentee fathers, you had abusive fathers. You were verbally abused. You were physically abused. You were sexually abused. And it's not distrust that you have towards your father. You hate him. And no one could blame you for that. And so you look at God the Father and you hate God the Father and you want nothing to do with him. He might cause as much pain as your earthly father did. Now, Jesus knew the power of your earthly father, and so he told the most profound story in Luke chapter 15 as the entryway of healing for any of you who have had destructive earthly fathers. It's a story that you're familiar with, even if you've never been to church. It's often called the prodigal son, but it's not about the son at all. You know the story. The son hated the father, stole his inheritance, went to a foreign land, wasted his life, is eating pig food, or actually begging to be able to eat the food of pigs, decides to go back and cower before his father and maybe be a slave in his father's home. That's the story of the son, but it's not about the son, is it? It's about the father. The father loved the son enough to give him freedom, and God loves you enough to create you in a scenario where you don't have to love him, where you can go to a distant land, and all of us have taken that. And when the son goes, it wasn't his provisions that he lived on. It was the father's provision that in every single scenario in the foreign land where the son thought he was doing it himself, it was actually the father taking care of him. And then when the son wants to come back and he's creating the fib to ask for forgiveness, he's shocked to find out that even before he got there, the father had forgiven him already. Forgiveness preceded anything else. And then when he's a long way off, still searching for home, it was the father who saw him and ran out to him and grabbed him and restored him. You see, it was always the father who loved and forgave and provided and restored and renewed. It was always the father. And this is the father who is in heaven, right? The promise here is not this. The promise is not, hey, God's not going to be absentee with you. That's just neutral. And God didn't come to be neutral with you. And it's not a promise where God's not ever going to take advantage of you. Of course he's not. But that's not the promise. Here's the promise. Listen, please. He wants you. The Father wants you. And he wants you just because he wants you. You didn't do anything lovely or great or beautiful. He looked at you and said, that's my child. I want that child, right? He wants your self-hatred and he wants your misery and he wants the moment where you're considering suicide and he wants all the events that you think that you've broken things beyond repair and he wants you in your shame and he wants you in your guilt and he wants you in your arrogance. He wants you in your elitism. He wants you when you've rejected him. He wants you. There could be nothing more sweet than that the Father looks down and says, I want you. And he wanted you so much that he sent his son so he could have you. Now, I love this. It's not just Father, is it? It's everlasting Father. And this word everlasting is not primarily an attribute of time. It's not that he'll always be. He will always be. But everlasting literally means immutable. That means unchanging. It means there's no variation due to shadows in him. And it means he doesn't be warm with you for a moment, and then when you've done something wrong, pull back, and he's kind of cold with you, and he's off with you, and he's playing games with you now, and then he's warm again. He's never that way. He's just like he was 2,000 years ago when he was hanging on the cross, and he said, "It's finished. I forgive them all." And he's just like that now, and 2,000 years from now, he's going to be exactly the same way towards you no matter what happens. He's everlasting. He knows no change at all. He's the unchanging Father, and he's promised what? Love that goes from generation to generation, and it's always steadfast. I love this quote that I read this week. The only person who can wake up the king at 2 a.m. and ask for a glass of water is a child. You're a child of the king. You should go to the king at 2 a.m. and ask for a glass of water. You should go to the everlasting Father today and ask for water. You should go to the king no matter what's happened, no matter when it is. For the king is your daddy, and the daddy looks down on his child and says, "I'm glad you woke me, son. I'm glad you're here, sweet daughter. I've been waiting for you. I've been looking for you." He's everlasting Father. It'll never change. And so he's wonderful counselor, and he's mighty God, and he's everlasting Father. And then Isaiah concludes it this way, and it's where we find our conclusion today. His name shall be called Prince of Peace. We were told for a long time that modernism and progressive thinking and Western morality and scientific advances is going to make the world safe, and there'll be no more violence, and we'll all wear the same unitard gray clothes and have the same sunglasses, and we'll talk the same and be the same. It'll just make us totally neutral, right? There'll be world peace because of science and because of our great morality, except it didn't happen. Right? The last 100 years prove it, but who cares about the last 100 years? The last 100 hours prove it. I watched a video this past week of a woman bowing down behind a table outside of a cafe in Paris, and a man with an AK-47 runs up, puts the barrel to her head, and pulls the trigger. For some reason, the gun didn't go off. It was the intervention of God. But that's not peace. That's not a lack of violence. And so what we've tried to do is create enough distance from all the chaos in the world. We've thought enough money, enough stuff, enough success, enough accolades will give us some insulation to the chaos that's out there. If we can live in fantasy worlds, if we can read enough or binge watch media enough or play fantasy football, then we'll have a little numbing of that. Or maybe enough relationships. If enough people can say enough good things and we can be adored by enough human beings, that as somehow the peace of God will settle down into our hearts, right? But it hasn't worked, has it? The moment that there's an instance of silence in your heart, your soul starts to reverberate with shame and with self-hatred and with guilt, and there's just no lasting peace for you on any level at all. And here's why that's the case. The loudest noise always reverberates most. The alarm system at the downtown church building here is unbelievably loud when a fire alarm goes off. You can't do anything but run. I've tried. I have an outer door to my office, so I'll close that, and there's no fire unit inside my office, and I'll close the inner door, and I'll put noise counseling headphones on and smash them into my head and try to work, and all I can hear is wah, wah, wah. You can't escape it. So ultimately, you run. You know what the loudest noise is in your life? No peace. You don't have peace with yourself. There's a lot of self-hatred in this place. There's a lot of looking back on your life and thinking you didn't do what you're supposed to do. You look behind you and there's a wake of brokenness, and you caused that brokenness. And if you're not there yet, wait like an hour and you'll be there pretty soon. You're not at peace with this world. You go to the Raleigh Christmas parade and you think, what if a crazy person brings a gun? Why do we have to think that? We have to think that because there's no peace in this world. And can we really say that there's peace with God? If I have no peace with myself and no peace with the world, do you think really God's going to look down and say, ah, we're perfect? And yet Jesus says this in John chapter 14. He's on the way to the cross. He's in Jerusalem. He's about to die. And he says, I leave you my peace. He's the Prince of Peace, and he's leaving you his peace, right? Jesus was the only human being ever at peace with himself. He could look back on his life and he could know, I always worshiped God and I always did the beautiful thing and I always loved other people. I never hurt anybody. I did precisely every single thing that God told me to do. I'm at peace with myself, Jesus says, and I'm giving you my peace. You have the peace of Jesus. You can love yourself because Jesus loved himself and Jesus is in you, and now you have peace with yourself. Jesus has peace with God. God the Father looked down on Jesus and said, this is my son in whom I am well pleased. My spirit dwells with him. This is my boy. We're totally right. There's never been anything between us. There's total reconciliation and peace. And now Jesus gives you his peace. You have total peace with God. God looks at you now and says, my sweet little daughter, I'm glad that you came at 2 a.m. and you woke me up. Finally, you're home. You have the peace of God, right? Do you see? Do you see how impossible it is to talk about the grandeur of Jesus? He's wonderful enough to astonish you. He's close enough to adore you. He's mighty enough to change you. And he gives you the peace that only God can instill into your hearts. This is the impossible possibility. God, the enormous deity of the universe, being born in human flesh so that you can be rescued. We love Jesus because he loved us first. Let's pray. God, we ask in this moment that you would meet us, Lord. Be this God. We want to hold you to this, God. You told us to hold you to these things. We want to hold you to being wonderful counselor. We need that, Lord. We want to hold you to the fact that you're mighty God. Only your might can heal us, God. We want to hold you to the fact that you're everlasting Father, that you look at these men and women and they're your sons and daughters and you'll never change your love. And the moment that they believe in Jesus, steadfast love of God is theirs. And you, Lord, you are Prince of Peace. You have alone the power to bring reconciliation between humanity and God. And Jesus gives us his peace. Thank you, Lord, for your peace. We love you, Jesus. We pray these things in your name. Amen.